The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Second hour, Jimmy Sangenberger filling in for George Brocker this morning right here on News Talk 710 KNUS. My thanks to Dr. Lee Gross out of Florida for joining us in the last couple of segments in the previous hour. Such an informative discussion on what's going on with COVID-19 in the hospitals versus how the CDC looks at the data, and some questions about vaccinations and masks. Interesting tidbits of information, definitely going to be worth checking out the podcast later if you missed that hour. We're going to shift gears here back to Afghanistan, where the president of the United States, Joe Biden, ordered a withdrawal of American military forces before even bringing out our people and our allies, the civilians there, and our Afghan partners that have put their lives on the line and now are facing Taliban forces going door to door, searching for people who collaborated with the United States of America. They've set up checkpoints. It is hard to even get to Kabul, even if you are an American citizen. What went wrong? Well, here is a little bit of a montage to get us started before we go to our incredible guest. It's President Biden this week speaking to George Stephanopoulos, then flashbacks to April, July, and earlier in August.
So you don't think this could have been handled? This actually could have been handled better in any way? No mistakes?
No, I don't think it could have been handled in a way that we're going to go back in hindsight and look, but the idea that somehow there's a way to have gotten out without chaos ensuing, I don't know how that happens.
We'll not conduct a hasty rush to the exit. We'll do it responsibly, deliberately, and safely. And we will do it in full coordination with our allies and partners.
Your own intelligence community has assessed that the Afghan government will likely collapse.
That is not true.
Can you please clarify what they have told you about whether that will happen or not?
That is not true. They did not reach that conclusion. The likelihood there's going to be the Taliban overrunning everything and owning the whole country is highly unlikely. The truth is, this did unfold more quickly than we had anticipated. So what's happened? Afghanistan political leaders gave up and fled the country. The Afghan military collapsed sometime without trying to fight.
What really is going on in Afghanistan right now, and what caused this disaster to happen versus what we might have otherwise anticipated, regardless of withdrawing, because certainly it wasn't going to be easy to withdraw. But if things were done differently, how much better would it really have been? Let's talk about some of these topics with Sergeant First Class medically retired, Lindsay Nuringer, who served in U.S. Special Forces in the 10th Group for about 10 years, just recently retired, has served in Africa, Afghanistan, 2016 and 2017, as well as Europe, and has been in close contact with folks and trying to help out as best he can in Afghanistan. Sergeant First Class Lindsay Nuringer, thank you so much. Good morning and welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you. And thank you for your service. Incredible 10 years in Special Forces. And remarkably, too, you were telling me, with your same group throughout pretty much that whole time.
Yeah, not only same group, but same detachment, which is not very common. And I'm very privileged to have done that.
Well, I appreciate your service. Truly grateful and very grateful for you coming on today. I know that you have a lot on your plate. You're trying to help do what you can from here in the United States with the folks in Afghanistan. But what is the state of affairs right now? You were telling me that you got new information in the last half hour. What are things like on the ground in Afghanistan right now, sir?
Yeah, so it's a lot has just really kind of fallen apart. We just got some updates this morning from the ground that the base is completely locked down. Not only is there just, you know, the swell of people outside the gates, but they have about 16,000 people inside. And there's been no flight since 10 a.m. yesterday. They've run into an issue where Afghans were spreading feces and urine on aircraft that then have to be sanitized. So it's grounded everything and kind of come to a halt. Not only with the lack of support that is on the airfield for Afghans, but our own people, with everything getting shut down, it's starting to become a food and water issue. You know, they're down to their MREs, which, you know, we're fine living on, but with the current influx of people and the, you know, the situation on the ground and the lack of support, it is becoming kind of almost a humanitarian issue.
I have a listener texting in saying, according to the Daily Mail, the U.S. Embassy is now telling people to not go to the airport. When you say the situation's deteriorated, just how bad is it, especially when you get outside of the city of Kabul?
Well, outside of the city, as I can't truly speak to, is most of the stuff that I've been focused on and kind of the little team that I've built. Sure. We've been able to get most of the people to the city. What is frustrating and kind of, you know, emotionally taxing through this as my inbox has exploded is the, you know, we've been telling people don't go to the airfield. They're not getting through the gate. And, you know, I had intel on the ground, there's about 5,000 people outside of each gate. So even if they go there, they're not getting up to the gate. But they're not listening. They're terrified. And so I'll get, you know, I'm talking directly to some of my Terps that I worked with there, and then they put me in direct contact with some of their families, and they just don't know what else to do. So they're going there just hoping that there is an option to get them inside the gate. And that's why we're trying to push out the information this morning that they are actually much better just finding a spot 20 to 30 minutes away from the airport. We've been able to consolidate all of the information that I've been passed onto a list to try to get people on manifest to different organizations, but at least that way they have a cell phone charger. They have, you know, potentially better access to food is kind of what we're prioritizing right now as we try to figure out the situation inside the airfield.
Again, we're talking with Sergeant First Class retired Lindsey Nurringer of Special Forces for about a decade, joining us here on 710 KNUS. Sir, when we talk about the door-to-door situation where, and I know this is getting outside of Kabul, but when you have the Taliban reportedly going door-to-door, seeking out people who collaborated with the United States, when you have Americans having a very difficult time getting to Kabul reportedly, and then, of course, even being able to get on planes and get out of the country, with you saying no flights since 10 a.m. yesterday, how did we get to this point, especially in such a short period of time?
Well, you know, kind of a couple things there. Yes, we are receiving, you know, intelligence that the Taliban is going door to door, but an equal concern is the State Department passing out the, you know, the flyer or the documents that people need to get to the airport, saying that, you know, they are manifested and have this clearance. But then the requirement is that it's printed out, that it can't be on a phone. So I've received a couple of reports of not so much a Taliban issue, but just another Afghan issue of people being beaten to death for that paper. As they get into the swell and someone sees that they have that paper, over the past couple of days, there's been, you know, 3 to 4, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it just gives a context of what is happening on the ground, of people legitimately being beaten to death just to get that paper, so thinking that it's going to get them through the gate. We've been having an issue. So NMRG is a unit that is very special to any operator, any team guy that we worked with there. And those are some of the people at the biggest security risk that a Taliban is going door to door and trying to find them. But then when you look at kind of how we got here, and again, this is going to be an opinion as opposed to, you know, complete, you know, doctrine as per se, but you know, my opinion is that the singular blame on Biden, you know, while there's obviously failures, is misled. As anyone in the military knows, you know, there's a systemic chain that goes up in planning anything like this. I personally put this on generals more than anything. As something like this happens, a end state is going to be dictated, and then that's going to trickle down as each person makes their plan along the way. So, you know, when the deal was made with the Taliban under Trump, the generals should have started to make a plan. So if you think of us, you know, say we were out and, you know, my detachment was really focused on ISIS, Nangarhar. But as we had to do anything exo-wise or getting people out, the instructions would come down to us as a detachment to formulate a plan on the ground. And then administratively above us, they would figure out air transport, things like that. We would then do consolidated meetings for everyone to sync together. It seems like that wasn't done, you know. But ultimately, there was thinking that we were going to end a 20-year war in, you know, a complete perfect scenario, I think, is naive. So I think that there could have been systemic things put in place over the past year or two. Something that I'm seeing as I'm getting sent everyone's paperwork and visa and becoming a consolidated point for all this information is I'm seeing visas and stuff from 2019 that haven't been acted upon. So I think it gives a glimpse into how far behind we are on this. And if we, you know, which is, it's honestly heart-wrenching for me, as we're seeing guys that, you know, what they've done for us, and they've legitimately gone through all of the proper channels for years now and just haven't been gotten out. So I think if how we could have avoided this is really starting to implement a plan well before this, you know, even before the Taliban deal was made, you know, years ago, trying to foresee this on the front. At some point we had to get out. And no groundwork was laid. I think that's the ultimate systemic failure. Absolutely no groundwork was laid for this.
How does that happen, though? Is it like they never anticipated that they would have a president finally execute a decision to withdraw, and so they didn't do that work? It seems to me that that's almost a dereliction of duty, if not directly a dereliction of duty on the part of these generals.
At every level. I think it's not only at – I mean, you're going to go to kind of down a rabbit hole here with – you know, kind of the military-industrial complex and things like that. And I don't want to be I'm not a conspiracy person. I try to be, like, you know, a fact person. Mm-hmm. So it's tough to kind of conjecture this.
Sure.
But they should have seen this coming. You know, they at least had contingency plans. Something that we're taught in group is, you know, as we go on at the mission level, you know, and all the way down to the operational level, that you have contingencies for everything. Before you go on a mission, you've got, you know, what they consider a PACE plan, primary, alternate, contingency, and emergency. And you have all of those things so you can flex to them as needed. And it seems that none of that was in place. And, you know, whether there's an appeasement process of, you know, at the political level and coming down to the generals, you know, and then down to the lower levels, I don't know. But there should have been more of a plan, obviously.
Well, and we do have, again, we're talking with Sergeant First Class, retired former Special Forces, Lindsey Nieringer, joining us, Jimmy Sangenberger in for George Brockler. We do have those reports that intelligence did warn the administration and the military about what could happen in terms of the speed with which the Taliban managed to overrun the country and Kabul. What do you make of that as a component to the planning process, if there actually was this intel that said, hey, guys, we're going to be overrun, or Kabul is even going to be overrun in no time if you execute on this soon?
Well, there's a couple of things that I kind of want to look at and talk to within that realm. So hindsight is always going to be, you know, 2020, and you know, looking back on this is everyone can be an armchair quarterback, but
of course,
You know, so an interview I was watching the other day that I agree with some points and some, you know, some points I do not, but, and I'm drawing a blank on the guy's name. He was interviewed on MSNBC. Mm-hmm. And he's been doing stuff of compiling data for getting people out. He's been doing it for years, but he brought up a great point that, you know, the Afghan soldiers were so, you know, not getting paid, but not getting fed, not treated properly. If the government just goes away, why should they be expected to continue to fight? I hadn't looked at it like that, and I was actually glad that I saw the interview, because I think it's a great point.
Well, and can I just
– there's no incentive. Yeah, for sure.
Amplify that point, because I heard along those lines with the president even fleeing the country. If the president flees the country, what message does that send to the rank and file of the security forces, the military for the country of Afghanistan? But also, in general, Jack Keane was making this point on Fox News this week. the United States was providing logistical support and intelligence, particularly air support. And when that is gone, then you don't have the mechanisms in place to really feel as comfortable in terms of providing that security. And then suddenly the president of Afghanistan is fleeing and you're like, well, what the heck does it, what does this send as far as a message to us? What are we really supposed to do here now?
Yeah, 100%. You know, even with our skill set as operators, having that air coverage in a place with the environment like Afghanistan, the enemy that we're facing, it was vital. And then even, you know, kind of a vignette for, you know, the aspect of the government leaving, we've been able to get a couple of our interpreters out over the past 2 years, just doing fundraising, things like that. And I'm very proud of that. And they're out in California now. And
good work.
Which is heart-wrenching because I talked to them, but their families are still there. Mm-hmm. They're kind of on my own personal priority list for trying to get out. But I talked to a gentleman named Hafiz the other day, who's my terp out in California, and he said that he's so disgusted with the Afghan government and how fast they left that he's just disgusted with his country. You know, even he just needs to get his family out, and even if he ever had the opportunity, he just would never go back. Like if a real government was in place, he's completely given up by the way that they handled this.
Sir,
that was hard to hear.
Yeah, and you add on top of that now the amount of military armament that is now in the hands of the Taliban, billions and billions of dollars worth of equipment, Black Hawk helicopters and planes, jets. We talk about weapons, firearms, and so forth. I mean, what are you hearing is on the ground there now in the hands of the Taliban? And what do you make of that, especially as someone who served in Afghanistan and now the United States is leaving behind all of this armament for the Taliban?
Yeah, I mean, we saw the same thing in Iraq, you know, as that kind of got overrun. And you know what, as kind of a comparative nature, it's kind of a foreshadowing thing for Afghanistan. When we pulled out of Iraq and that was overrun in a day, I think we, you know, maybe should have taken a little lesson learned from that. But yeah, it's difficult. I think that not just the armament, but the funding that they now have, you know, the Taliban now controls the Afghan National Bank. And I saw something the other day, it was like $150 billion or something like that. Taliban's become one of the most well-funded organizations in the world. So to see, you know, wondering what's going to come of that, I have no idea. You know, I think what is concerning across the military forces is, you know, down to the personnel level, is guys thinking that because they have all that and it's all stuff that we've supported, like, why were we there ever to begin with? You know, and guys facing the mental issue of, was, you know, their buddy that they lost, or, you know, mine are just some physical injuries, but guys had, you know, both legs blown off or things like that. Like, was all that for nothing? You know, that now that they're seeing everything that the Taliban has, and I don't know the answer to that, frankly.
How does it make you personally feel as someone who served in special forces for 2 years in Afghanistan, Sergeant First Class Neringer?
That is also difficult. You know, I used to think that that we were fighting there for, this kind of separates the difference between Taliban and other terrorist groups and what we were doing there. Because I personally see, I mean, the Taliban, I disagree with everything that they do, but they're not really an international terrorist organization. You know, they want their government, and, you know, as much as they mistreat their people, and you look at the humanitarian side, I looked at what I was doing more on the ISIS front, because, again, that was our main target set. So fighting them there kept them from being here. So I did see value in that. Also, you know, going on back-to-back rotations in the same area and seeing the successes that we had in clearing ISIS out and then coming back and seeing farmland back there and, you know, kids running in the street, is that felt amazing. And that was rewarding, and that gave kind of purpose and value to, I don't know if value is the right word, but justification, or I didn't feel like the people that we lost were in vain, because we were seeing results. But how that now translates into losing the country as a whole. It's been so fast. I don't know that I've truly emotionally been able to figure that out, honestly. I've been so wrapped up in the emotional aspect of trying to get, you know, the Terps and their families out and NMRG and those people that are close to us that I don't know that I've had time to really process my own thoughts, frankly.
Sure.
I worry about the families of those that are lost probably more than anyone. You know, was their son, their brother killed for absolutely nothing? Because at least I have some of the on the ground context and memories of seeing some of the difference that we made to the people in the village, and seeing the look in their eyes. And is the Taliban now going to overrun that and make that offer not? Potentially, you know, I'd almost even say probably. But, you know, to the mother out there that lost her son that has none of that context, mm-hmm. I just can't imagine putting myself in their place. And, I think it's going to be – I think that over the coming months, we're going to see a huge issue with some of the way that people mentally process this.
Just a couple of final questions for you, and I so appreciate your time this morning, Sergeant First Class retired Lindsay Neringer, again, former U.S. Special Forces for about 10 years, including a couple years in Afghanistan. If you were to go into the White House and get a chance to sit down with President Biden to give your input on what he should do now with regards to Afghanistan, what would you tell him? What would you advise him?
It's so hard because I don't agree with influxing boots on the ground. You know, that's only going to spiral this back up. And myself and a lot of experienced operators have wanted to get out of Afghanistan for years. We truly have just not wanted to be there. And we just keep losing friends and becoming so, you know, jaded on the war. So I don't think that fluxing in too much is the answer, but, you know, at least get maybe a footprint better on the ground on Kabul, just to get better gate control. Because something I want to highlight that has been putting out, like on Fox News and stuff, is I'm not seeing Taliban checkpoints as being the issue. That's not the feedback I'm getting on the ground. People can get to the airport. And getting aircraft out. It's not the Taliban. So whatever control of those gates and get people vetted in, and also just trust us as operators. I've had, you know, 30 special forces guys. The responsibility that we are given by our government on the ground, like, you should trust the networks that we've built and the vouching that we do for people. Take our list. Let us get them in the gate. Let us get them to whatever, you know, staging point, cutter, whatever it may be, and start this. You know, State Department can then come in and vet, but at least let us get those people out and whatever mechanisms that takes. Start. There's so much fundraising out there for private aircraft now that, figure out a mechanism for getting them in and just, you know, but control the gate and whatever mechanism that takes. And ultimately, it's not a Biden thing. It's get with the generals and figure out. I almost cursed. Sorry. I just get frustrated with this.
Figure out
a plan on the ground, you know? That's something is our failure right now is at the gate. It's not the Taliban stopping us. It's our own infrastructure.
Wow. That is stunning to hear. Again, Sergeant First Class retired Lindsay Neringer, our guest. Just want to ask you a broad question before we let you go, sir. And again, I so appreciate your time. Is there anything that we haven't touched on that you think our listeners should know about or keep in mind as we examine, watch the news, see what's going on, talk about what's going on in Afghanistan?
Actually, there is something. We're focused so much on failures at every level here, but something that I've been really proud to see is the way people have come together behind the scenes to try to make a difference at the last minute. You know, politicians are going to fail. It's what they do. You know, we are really broken at that level, but, you know, even the small team that I've been able to create just through social media posts and people reaching out and saying, hey, I have this asset on the ground, or I can do this. I have this asset in D.C. to, you know, push names to. You know, my friends are reaching out just for administrative functions. And, you know, when this is all this is done, and I'm going to ask guys, you know, what names, you know, I can push out and just kind of saying thank you, and I will. But, you know, even at as we moved up the chain, all, everything that I've been able to do started with Eli Bremer. He's a friend of mine. And I got reached out to by one interpreter of mine to try to get his family out. And I reached out to Eli to see if he had any avenue of connection. And he immediately, within literally 10 minutes, I had a email connection with one of the guys that's been paramount in the team that I've built. And as I continue to reach out to Eli, he's just been there for me. And you know, I do want to highlight that.
Well, I appreciate that. And Eli is the one who put us in touch as well. And of course, he's running now
absolutely.
For United
he
States.
He continues to do it.
And he's now running for United States Senate here in Colorado.
Yeah,
well, Sergeant First Class Lindsey Neringer, I really appreciate your time today. I'm so grateful for your service. I am words cannot express for me either how sorry I am so many of us are for how things have gone and developed after so much sacrifice from you and your friends and those that you saw lose their lives, people that you got to know. But we are so grateful to you, all of you, and your service is not in vain, because it really has meant so much to so many people in the world, regardless of what's happening now, and to our country here. So thank you so much for all of that.
Thank you so much, sir.
God bless you, and thanks for joining us. Best of luck, especially right now in the mission in Kabul. Again, Sergeant First Class Lindsey Neringer joining us here on The George Show. Jimmy Sangenberger in for George Brockler, Special Forces for about a decade. A true American hero, and I'm so grateful for his time this morning. We are needing to take a break here. We'll be right back. We'll pick up on the phones briefly. 303-696-1971. I'm Jimmy Sangenberger in for George Brockler. News Talk 710 KNUS. Coming back, Jimmy Sangenberger here with you in for George Brockler this morning. News Talk 710 KNUS. What a powerful interview with Sergeant First Class retired Lindsey Neringer, 10 years in U.S. Special Forces, recently medically retired. Served in Africa, Afghanistan from 2016 and 2017, as well as in Europe, and he's doing a lot of work to try and get folks who have helped the United States, Afghanis in particular, out of that country, out of the clutches of the Taliban. And he said things are shut down, that the situation has deteriorated even more. And he had so many stunning insights as well. If you missed that interview, definitely want to check out the podcast later when it is up for the second hour. We just got a couple minutes left in this segment. Let's go to Cheryl in Arvada. Cheryl, you're on with Jimmy Sangenberger in for George.
Well, good morning, Jimmy.
Good morning.
All week when I'm listening to different shows, everyone's, and I agree, that was one of my first thoughts, was to get our partners that helped us out. We did the same thing in Vietnam. We left them behind. So that was my first concern. But now that I'm hearing that there's tens of thousands of Americans, and nobody's talking about getting the Americans out, I want them out first.
So,
and nobody knows how many or where they're at or seems to care.
Of course. That is one of the issues that we were touching on, though, in terms of being able to get into Kabul. And what he was saying was whether they are Afghanis, they are Americans, it is the United States right outside of Kabul that is failing to do the job. It's not even the Taliban, he's saying, that are the biggest problem for so many, particularly Americans.
Well, I heard early on they're telling the Americans to get in touch with the embassy. What embassy? There is no embassy there anymore.
Yeah.
And why didn't we blow that building on our way out? We left a nice headquarters for the Taliban.
When we're talking about the weapons left behind.
I know it.
We've armed them.
Absolutely.
Literally armed them. And yes, the big blunder, biggest travesty of how Biden has done this, in concert with his generals who clearly failed here, in concert with the intelligence community that reportedly gave warnings but clearly weren't, you know, strong enough in winning the argument, how they did this with withdrawing troops before getting our people out there is astonishing.
Well, I'm speechless. I really am. I'm speechless, but I'm just heartbroken. All our people, all these years that bled and died. And so what we just kicked them to the side and say, sorry, it didn't mean anything, when of course it did to all of us.
Oh, no, absolutely. And that's why when I asked Sergeant First Class Neringer what he thinks, how he feels, he couldn't give a real answer because he hasn't had time to process it. And I can imagine how many families are exactly in that position, how many servicemen and women who have given so much for our country in Afghanistan are feeling exactly that way, where they don't know yet how to make up any sense of it.
Well, if you look at Vietnam, even worse, because they spit on them when they returned home.
Yes.
Our military had spit on them and called them names. I mean, so in a way, it was even worse. But I just am astounded that some people, and the media, well, the left-wing media, they're not asking those questions either about the Americans.
Well, actually, I think that the media is doing a surprisingly harder-hitting job because it's so bad. It's that bad that the media, that CNN and MSNBC, that they're drilling into Biden.
I've been surprised, too, because they have, in comparison to what they've done for the last year with Biden, they are hard-hitting, actually.
Yeah.
So that has been a surprise, and it's welcome.
That's a welcome surprise, but it's because things are so bad and so horrifying, and they have colleagues that are in the country who are witnessing it firsthand. Cheryl, I got to go,
thank you so much. Call, Jimmy.
Absolutely. I really appreciate it. Cheryl joining us here, Jimmy Sangenberger in for George Brockler. We got to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to shift back briefly to COVID and specifically what's happening in our schools with mask mandates coming down from health authorities and more. We'll talk with one concerned parent and discuss a petition that is out and about right now. There are plenty of petitions along these lines. We're going to take a quick break. We will be back with Anna Christine Smith here on 710 KNUS. Isn't this apropos right now as we talk for a few minutes about mask mandates in schools? You know, all across the state, Jimmy Sangenberger, by the way, in for George Brockler this morning. We will get to the phones very briefly in the next hour on Afghanistan. Then I want to switch to the topic of Mesa County Clerk Tina Peters in the next hour. But we'll hit a very brief calls and the other side of the hour. You want to stay on the line. But when it comes to these mask mandates in schools, oftentimes now coming from health departments like Tri-County Health. And I think that there's a ban that you can make out of it. You know, the executive director of the Tri-County Health Department is Dr. John Douglas, who I actually interviewed last year. And even at the time, he didn't care about and hadn't even thought about the cost-benefit analysis of their policies of shutdowns. At the time, it was during lockdowns, and he didn't even give a thought to it. Well, I think if they were to form a band, it would be Dr. John Douglas and the Tri-County Tyrants. And their harmonica player really sucks. Like, he's not a good player, kind of sucks. That's the band. And I am fed up, like so many. I don't have kids myself, but I'm fed up with these bureaucrats making these decisions, and then the counties have to opt out. And we see Douglas County opting out of Tri-County Health, which includes Arapahoe, Adams, and Douglas counties. So at least the order of Tri-County Health. Their commissioners voted unanimously this week to do that, although Douglas County Schools still says, hey, we're going to have our own mandate for kids ages 2 to 11. But if the Tri-County Health Order is in effect, it also includes Sunday schools and private schools and charter schools and traditional K through 12 schools. And they're not caring about the impact. Well, there are petitions online, including one in Adams County, Parents for Mask Choice in Tri-County Health Boundary. That's a change.org petition. I will tweet it out here in just a little bit. It's been put together by 27J Parents for Change. And I'm very pleased to be joined by one concerned mother of four, including three kids ages 4, 7, and 10 in that school district. And we have right now joining us our guest for this segment, Anna Christine Smith. Anna, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jimmy. Good morning.
Good morning. It's so great to have you here. So let me just put it to you. What's going on with Tri-County Health, and why are you so upset about it, and rightfully so?
Oh, well, that's a good question. What is going on with them? It seems like they are not following the data that's going on in our area, in our local area especially. It's very clear that this seems like it's a political agenda. And like you said, I'm with a group called 27J Parents for Change, which was started by Katie and Matt Southard. So if you want more information, you can email them at 27jparents@gmail.com.
Okay.
We also are in contact with other school counties and school districts. So we can contact them if you want to get a hold of your own local area. But this is ridiculous. They have a mandate they're putting in place that's only for children 2 through 11 years old. I mean, putting a 2-year-old in a mask, it seems like they're doing this because those kids are not eligible for the COVID shot yet.
Mm-hmm.
Or should I say the COVID injection, whatever you want to call it. But we're just fed up because if you look at the local stats in Colorado, in 2020, we had 0 healthy kids die from COVID. 0. There were 18 with comorbidities, but they died with COVID, not from COVID. This is not affecting our kids. According to even the CDPHE stats, we've had 30,000 cases recently of COVID in this past year,
mm-hmm.
and only 3 deaths, which is horrible. It's so sad, but they were with comorbidities. And if you look at the hospital stats, which is, I think, most important, because we talk about cases. Well, we also have flu cases and cold cases,
mm-hmm.
and we don't inflate those. They're pretty similar in size. But according to the CDC, the last 3-day rolling average, we've had 3 kids in the hospital under 18, which is 0.05% of 100,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
So the hospitals are not overwhelmed. And in Colorado, for 100,000 people, we've had 1.61 people in hospitals. And these aren't deaths. These are just kids in hospitals or people in hospitals of all ages.
Right.
And I know that's hard. We don't want anyone to be going to the hospital, but that's not a huge, huge, huge number. It's not justifying, like you said, the cost benefit of this. But we are worried about when we put these kids in masks, what's it doing to them? We put them in masks all day long at school. They're getting deprived of oxygen. They can't see facial cues. What's this going to do to them long term? We're starting to see those effects. And one of the main things that Tri-County, when they did their Zoom meeting, one of the main things they said was, we need to worry about this Delta variant. But if you look at a quote from the Douglas County Commissioners meeting, they said that the Tri-County and local hospitals have yet to supply peer-reviewed scientific research that shows that the Delta variant is more dangerous for children.
There you go. Here's the question. What is the basis, the scientific basis upon which they have made this decision? And when will they release that information?
Well, they haven't.
I know. When will they? If they even will they even do so? But I think you're hitting on something so important, Anna Christine Smith, and that is, and you know this as a parent of 4 kids with one who's 10 years old now. So you go to your 4-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
When they're developing as young children, especially, those facial cues are so important in understanding emotional connection, in having reassurance and things that are making a sense of comfort in the classroom, especially when they've been deprived of like 1.5 years of in-person learning.
Yeah. Yeah, and we tried to talk to them, to Tri-County. We said, well, let's think about the mental health issue that's going on here. And a quote from the Tri-County Zoom meeting, they addressed it a little bit. They said, well, yes, we are in a mental health crisis. And I quote, they said, for whatever reason, like they're not even addressing that.
Well, they never did so last year. And I remember talking to John Douglas, Dr. John Douglas, the executive director of Tri-County Health last year, over a year ago. It was like last April, I think, when we were doing the lockdowns. And he didn't even bat an eye about that then. And now where they're probably like, well, hey, your kids are in school now. So what are you complaining about? That's quite an attitude to have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is. Yeah, another person from the Tri-County Zoom meeting said that she was going to be voting for the mask mandate, and the first thing she said was, based off personal experience.
Well,
what does that have to do with the data?
Yeah, no, definitely. You should be looking at the scientific data. Anna Christine Smith, we are just about out of time here. I do want to say you were telling me results of a survey that Tri-County Health put out. 74% were against force. Use of force, 31% were for a mandate, 8% wanted a mandate for including anybody who comes in contact with 2 to 11-year-olds, which I think could include any 7th or 8th grade kids as well who are in middle school. But what's the bottom line for you really briefly, and where can people go for this petition?
Yeah, so we just want this to be something that's in the hands of the parents. This should be something that parents choose to do. We are going to the Adams County Government Building on Tuesday, and we're going to be trying to talk to the commissioners just to do some peaceful talking. We're not calling it a protest. We're just saying we're going to show up 9:30 a.m., and we just want this to be in the hands of the people. I know that Arapaho is also parents are working there, so if you go to arapahogov.com, mm-hmm. You can take their survey, and you can voice your concern as a parent there, because I think all of us are – areas we just need to band together as parents. And
where's the petition?
So our petition, are you talking about?
Yeah, so the change.org petition, which is now at over 5,600 signatures, closing in on 7,500. Really quick.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can find it floating around on Facebook if you just Google change petition and you specifically type in parents for mask choice in Tri-County Health Boundary. You should be able to find it.
Absolutely. All right. Well, I'm going to tweet it out as well, at Sang Center, Sang with an E, not an A, Center on Twitter. Unfortunately, we have to run. But Anna Christine Smith, thanks so much for speaking up and speaking out. Really appreciate your time this morning. And best of luck.
Thank you for your time, Jimmy. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. We're going to take a quick break. Jimmy Sangenberger in for George Brockler. Another hour up ahead. News Talk 710 KNUS.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.